President Donald Trump is on trial. What can we learn from the trial? And what will happen next? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name's Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a CNN legal analyst. I'm usually joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, but she's still on the campaign trail, so let's get right to it and start bringing in our guests. But before I do, let me just take 20 seconds and thank our patrons who brought you this episode, with special thanks to Michelle Dew, Eric DeWurst, Edie, James Frohmeyer, Jamie Gordon, Steve Hungsberg, and an anonymous patron. You can become a patron, too, on our website, www.ontopicpodcast.com, all one word. Just click the support link at the top of the page. So let's bring in our first guest, Joe Lockhart. Joe's had a storied career, and you've seen him, I'm sure, on CNN with me even at times. But really what Joe is best known for and really brings to this conversation is that he was the White House press secretary during the presidency of Bill Clinton, specifically during the period of time in which President Clinton was impeached and ultimately was acquitted by the Senate. So he was there when it happened. He was involved in a lot of the backroom conversations with the lawyers and the advisors and others. And he can help us understand not only that impeachment, but the impeachment of President Trump and what we can learn from that prior impeachment. So let's bring in Joe Lockhart. Thank you and welcome to the podcast, Joe.
Glad to be here.
We have heard throughout this impeachment, the Clinton impeachment coming up constantly, Republicans repeatedly invoking it, for example, to justify the way in which they've set up the trial. We hear commentators constantly comparing the Clinton impeachment to this one. It's somebody lived through the Clinton impeachment, not the way you did, but at least was watching it intently as a law student and then a little after as a young lawyer. I have to say, they seem like two very different situations to me. Do you share that view?
Yeah, there's really no comparison. Start with the offense. Clinton's was an unforgivable error in judgment that it really had no impact on the country or our national security. But it's still unforgivable. And I think he accepted responsibility that he put the country through a really hard time and apologized multiple times. With Donald Trump, who still contends that he's done nothing wrong, and as do his lawyers, this has to do with our national security and has to do with the sanctity of our elections. The two probably most important things that happen in the Oval Office, protecting our democracy and protecting our safety. So that's, you start with that. Let's go to the Clinton rules that they said they were nothing like what Mitch McConnell put down on paper. The Clinton rules were negotiated by Tom Daschle and Trent Lott, and they got 100-0 vote on it. The White House was unhappy with it. The House managers were unhappy with it, which meant they got it right. They found a middle ground that every senator in the chamber could agree with. And the biggest difference, in the context of the rules, was every witness that you could possibly want to hear from, some 65 witnesses, went before the grand jury and testified under oath extensively for hundreds of hours. No one has been before a grand jury. The main people with firsthand information are being blocked from testifying. So you cannot compare it there in terms of process either. Finally, there was a seriousness about the Clinton impeachment, even if it was just about a personal mistake. Democrats, one after another, went to the floor in both the House and the Senate and criticized the president openly, bitterly, and repeatedly for this failure in basic human judgment. That didn't mean they voted to remove him. But they said they basically acknowledged that the president had created this problem. Now we have House Republicans who say the president did nothing wrong. And Senate Republicans, who not only are going to agree that he did nothing wrong, but will likely vote to keep evidence out of the trial that's directly relevant to the trial, shows a lack of seriousness on their part. The last thing I'll say, and I referenced this a minute ago, President Clinton took responsibility for this. He apologized multiple times in a very heartful way. Donald Trump doubles down on attacking people, saying he did nothing wrong. And there's just no, I find no common point of interest to compare the two presidencies, except for they worked out of the same office.
Yeah, I have to say, I can't imagine two different, very different presidencies myself. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because President Clinton paid in many ways a high price for that failing. Frankly, the 2000 election in many ways was a referendum on, that aspect of his presidency. The Republicans used the term, bringing dignity and honor and so forth back to the White House. They wanted to restore that. And that was, I thought, a sort of them tipping their cap to, or subtly saying that they wanted to, not have any sort of indignity that President Clinton, referring to what had happened with President Clinton. And in addition to that, as you pointed out, I mean, there were a number of Democratic senators, most notably Joe Lieberman, but others who spoke in detail about how concerning they thought his conduct was. There's none of that here. And one thing I wonder is whether or not President Trump is going to learn anything from this. In other words, the lesson he may draw from this is that there's no consequences for any potential misdeeds, and he really has the authority to do what he wants.
Yeah. I mean, let's remember that the now iconic, or pivotal phone call that the president made to President Zelensky happened the day after the Mueller report came out. Now, the Mueller report did not exonerate the president. It did not fully exonerate him on collusion. It just said that they couldn't put the evidence together, and that was in large part to the fact that witnesses wouldn't cooperate and that they were not available to get at the encrypted messages. So that doesn't tell me that there was no collusion. They just couldn't prove it. But the obstruction stuff was very straightforward. The president obstructed justice, and as a special counsel, I can't indict him. So Congress, you take it. But through the auspices of Bill Barr and a bunch of other dishonest people, they were able to rhetorically work their way out of any responsibility there. And the president was emboldened the very next day. The very next day after Bob Mueller's, candidly poor performance on the Hill, he pushed a scheme that we now know from the Lev Parnas tape began in 2018, when Marie Yovanovitch, the ambassador to Ukraine, was removed. This had been in the works for now over a year to do all of the things that the president wanted, which was get the Ukrainian government to investigate Joe Biden and to get the Ukrainian government to take the rap for what Russia did in the 2016 election. So he will be emboldened by this. There is no doubt. And again, it's a critical point. You can put up any of the White House defenses and tear it apart pretty quickly. But let me tear apart their headline, which is, if you look at the New York Times, the Sunday edition of the New York Times, it says White House lawyers say they're trying to steal the election. The whole idea that this is trying to nullify 2016 is belied by the facts, which is Nancy Pelosi and leading Democrats held off, did not want to impeach the president, wanted to do this at the ballot box. It was only when the Ukraine issue came out and it became clear that he was trying to manipulate the next election that they felt they had no other choice to impeach him. So the idea that this is somehow a political witch hunt is not supported by the facts. And in fact, the facts make the opposite argument that, in fact, the Democrats may have waited too long and, may have allowed too much damage to be done. But, try telling that to a Republican in the Senate.
Yeah, I have to say one important difference between this impeachment and the Clinton impeachment is that in Trump's case, there's so much misconduct one has to choose from in terms of potential articles of impeachment that really, you know, I was one of those people advocating to take a, you know, have a simple story and just, you know, keep the articles lean. But there are many people arguing for all sorts of other offenses. For example, the obstruction of justice episodes that you mentioned before being added, that was very different than the case of someone like President Clinton, who was a very popular president and, you know, was somebody who certainly was criticized, but was not widely engaged to be engaging in illegal acts.
Yeah, no, I think, on the other side of that debate. I thought they should have at least put in the obstruction of justice out of Mueller, only because you could then say, here's a crime. Abuse of power, you know, is criminal. It may not violate a statute that's written down, you know, and, you know, that you can cite, you know, the way lawyers do. But that's, you know, that was a close call, and I don't think that is going to have a large impact. You know, I think it's interesting if you look at this, you know, if you just look at the popularity of the president. President Clinton, the day the Star Report was released, and remember, it was a brutal year of leak after leak after leak about, because Star's strategy was to get the president to resign. He could count heads in the Senate. He knew what a steep hill it was to have the president removed. And he and his deputies pursued a strategy to continually leak material that would force Democrats on the Hill to go down and tell the president it was time to leave. So, you know, a la Richard Nixon. That obviously didn't work. But the day the Star Report was released, the president was at 63% job approval because people thought he was doing a good job. And the day he was impeached in 1998 in December, he got to 73% job approval, the highest of his presidency. Just happened to be the day Gallup researched this and tracks it once a week, and they've been doing it since the 1960s. So the strategy that the president employed, which was I'm going to focus on my job, worked really well. The economy was strong. That had a lot to do with it. But if you look at Trump, he has pursued the opposite strategy, which is I'm a victim. I'm going to be self-indulgent and self-pitying, and I'm going to attack my opponents. He too has a reasonably strong economy, not as strong as he says, but he's stuck at 43% job approval. He has 51% of the country, according to a Fox poll. So let's not say it's the mainstream liberal media trying to distort the numbers, want him removed from office. That's a pretty daunting number, you know, in an election year. So I think it says something about the difference in the climates, about the difference in the strategies, but also the differences in the presidents, you know, as leaders and, you know, as men and, you know, what kind of character they have.
Well, you know, one thing you mentioned a moment ago was the strategy that President Clinton and his administration had. And one line of punditry that I saw before we got to the Senate trial that I thought seemed flawed to me, I'm curious about your perspective, was comparing the sort of the PR and media strategy of the Clinton White House and saying that Trump and his team are going to use what Clinton did as a model for how they were going to handle the strategy of defending the impeachment. It seems to me what Trump is doing is very different than what the Clinton team did. And I'm curious what your thought is. Well, that is.
You know, this all got caught up, and sometimes the media gets a little too focused on labels and cliches and things. So this, a lot of this punditry was around, you know, will Trump have a war room? You know, because Clinton had a war room. Now, I was the White House press secretary, and I never saw the war room. Maybe one existed. And my guess is I knew there were extra people who were brought in, and they were working someplace, and maybe they called it the war room. But yeah, one would think if it was an integral part of the president's defense, I would have seen it. So, and the White House was, you know, saying we're not going to have a war room. The press was saying, why aren't they? And they eventually did. But the strategies were fundamentally different. You cannot compare the strategies. Bill Clinton, I guess it was 2 or 3 days after the story broke, stood in the Roosevelt Room, said something about the allegations and whether they were true or false, and then didn't speak about them again until the grand jury. Now, after the grand jury and the truth came out, he spoke about it occasionally, but only in the context of taking responsibility and you know, saying he was sorry. You never quite know on that politically how it will react. Sometimes you just roll the dice and you do what the president thinks is the right thing. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You know, Trump, you know, he's, even though the Mueller report kind of morphed into the Ukraine scandal, his strategy never changed. It was all a witch hunt. It was all a hoax. You know, again, he could, as he said, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, the guy could be dead, and he'd say it's a hoax. The guy's alive. You know, no one shot him, even if it was on video. So that's, you know, that is a big difference. I'll tell you one other big difference, and it's something to watch for this week when the defense goes out. The president had some very able lawyers. President Clinton had some very able lawyers. He had a number of lawyers from Williams & Connolly, which is a very good law firm, David Kendall, Nicole Seligman. They represented the president, and they made no bones about it. They were on the floor of the Senate representing the president. But the other lawyers, led by Chuck Ruff, did not represent the president. They represented the presidency. And, you know, I think people on the outside may say, oh, that's not true. Everybody's a homer in the White House. And it is true. And I'll give you an anecdote that will show you how true it is. The night before Chuck Ruff was giving his opening statement, which was phenomenal piece of legal work, something I haven't seen since Adam Schiff, you know, last week, called me up to his office and had a yellow legal pad in his hand. And he said, I'm going to show this to you. Not many people have seen it, but I'm going to show it to you under one condition. And I said, you know what? And he said, you cannot talk to the president about it. And he shoved it across and I read it. And it was his opening statement, you know, written out in longhand. And, you know, it was amazing. And I think he wanted one non-lawyer to see it. Just, you know, for a different set of eyes. And I was one of the political people. And I pushed it back and I said, this is amazing. And I said, why won't you let the president see this? And, you know, I'm shorthanding here, but he said, basically, he's not my client. My client is this building. My client is this office. I don't need to share it with, you know, David Kendall's client. I think he was obviously he was there as a supporter of the president, but he was defending the presidency there. You know, if you look at what you saw Saturday with the White House lawyers, there wasn't a single lawyer there defending the presidency. They're all part of the corrupt law firm led by Bill Barr and Rudy Giuliani that's defending Donald Trump. And that, you know, in some ways, that's the biggest difference between then and now, that the institutions have failed us. The Senate has failed us. The House Republicans have failed us by not taking this seriously. And, you know, you wonder why people don't take the government seriously. You wonder why people don't show up election day, because now their elected officials aren't taking it seriously. And that has a contagious and, you know, a toxic effect on our politics and ultimately our democracy.
Yeah, I have to say one of the other corrosive things that has really eaten away at our democracy, in my view, is sort of this attack on truth by the Trump and his allies, the Trump team, and this promotion of a sort of alternative set of set of facts and an alternative reality. Obviously, that was something that, you know, there was some talk of that during the George W. Bush presidency, but it's really at another level. And I think it's very striking here. Because during for example, the Clinton impeachment, everyone basically agreed as to what the facts were. There was the reason there was not a lot of debate about witnesses is because everyone knew what happened and the president acknowledged essentially what happened. And it was really a question of whether or not it was an impeachable offense. And that was something that Starr kind of hijacked in a way because he was independent counsel, is a different statute at the time. He basically just said, you know, he labeled these counts and presented them to the House as if the impeachability of these things was settled, Whereas now, the question here is so much deeper than that. We don't really know what happened. And they're trying to, it seemed to me his lawyers at times were pushing an alternative view of reality, which was a scary thing to me.
Yeah, I mean, this picks up on a little bit. If you think about Chuck Ruff writing an opening statement and refusing to show it to the president, and trust me, the president wanted to see it. He was working his sources, and Chuck was holding it close to his vest. There is such a contrast. I have some level of sympathy for Trump's lawyers on the floor of the Senate. Again, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know who's a great lawyer, who's not a great lawyer. And there were a couple of them who I thought made reasonable cases, not based on the truth, but they presented themselves well. And there were a couple of them that I thought were embarrassing. If I was a lawyer, I'd be embarrassed. But all of them were operating with the same restriction, which was, it was clear Trump said to them, start and finish every sentence with, "I did nothing wrong." Well, again, I didn't go to law school, but I've for a long time made a living trying to persuade people about a point of view. And if you start every sentence with, "The sun rose in the west today, now let me tell you what else I think," no one's going to listen. If there is a weakness in your argument, you have to acknowledge it, usually up front. And they just didn't do it. But they did something, we all know the president's a liar. I don't know why people have such a hard time using that word. It's not, my kids, have gone through a couple of phases where everything they say is a lie because they're testing you. Trump's a liar. He doesn't tell the truth. That's, you call people who don't tell the truth a liar. And the fact that his lawyers would perpetrate lies on the floor of the Senate is not surprising because they are speaking for the president. What is more dangerous, though, is, I just thought that the worst performance from the president's defense team was Jay Sekulow, who I think is out of his league here. But he did something that people are going to look back on and is going to become much more significant with time when we get out of this. He took, in the House hearings, it was clear from everybody who testified about the CrowdStrike Ukrainian debunked conspiracy theory about Ukraine being behind the interference in our election, not Russia. And, Dr. Hill was the most eloquent, which she said, she basically said at one point, "I want to warn everyone in this room. When you say that, you're using Russian talking points. You are helping spread and validate Russian disinformation." And Jay Sekulow went on the floor of the Senate in defense of the president and did that. Now, he knew full well that this is Russian propaganda and Russian disinformation designed to undermine not only the Ukraine, but undermine the United States of America. It is an act to me that, borders on treasonous. That if you go in and you start arguing an enemy's point of view that hurts your country and your allies, I don't know what else to call it. And I think with time, I think Sekulow will go down in history as one of those people who put his own interests, like the president's, ahead of the country's.
It's interesting. I couldn't agree more, although it's interesting. I've always had a sort of low expectations for Mr. Sekulow. He struck me as somebody who's a self-promoter, I guess. I mean, he's not somebody I view as a real serious lawyer. Mr. Cipollone is a serious lawyer, and I will say that in many ways, from my different perspective, I'm more disappointed in him. Because from the day he started signing those letters saying that the impeachment...
Yeah. I mean, the eight-page letter was, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but it was either written by the president or a four-year-old who decided he was going to go to law school, but not by a real lawyer.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a legal document at all. It can't be understood as a legal document. It's just sort of like the impeachment is unconstitutional, and it was all, it was a diatribe. And Cipollone started signing his letters to that stuff, and he's been on the floor of the Senate talking as if, he talks as if he's the author of that letter at times. And, if there was a Donald Trump sort of figure had hired me, I could not bring myself to be doing that sort of thing on the floor of the Senate, and I would think that most serious lawyers could not. So, you know, that's the sort of thing. And I, you know, a lot of my listeners were asking, is there going to be any consequences for lying on the floor of the Senate? I don't think so. You know, there's not, it's not, you know, I don't think bar associations are going to get in the middle of that, and they'll probably view it as not a real legal proceeding in the way that it is in front of a court. But it is disturbing to me to see that. And I think that's, there's a sort of disinformation element. It seemed to me, Joe, almost like they were trying to provide an excuse for Republicans. Republicans are essentially, they have a result and they're looking for an excuse to reach that result. And so they're just trying to provide a bunch of different possible excuses for senators to choose from.
Well, if you look at the defenses of the president and even the communications and documents, the few documents we have seen, it, you know, I learned, you know, every time you watch a lawyer give a great presentation, you learn two or three Latin phrases. So for last week, it was post hoc, post hoc rationalizations. The entire American policy towards Ukraine and Russia was a post hoc rationalization of, I got to get some dirt on Joe Biden. And, you know, I look at Cipollone, and again, I don't know what kind of lawyer he is. I don't know what his reputation was, but I know what it is now. And it's the same reputation of everybody in year three at the White House, which is the people with principles and the people who would stand up to Trump are gone. They've been gone for a year and a half, 2 years. These are the people who look at this and say, you know, I know he's a clear and present danger to the country, but I'm going to make something good about it for me. When this is over, I'm going to have a bunch of Republican donors hire me as a lawyer. When this is over, I'm going to get a Fox News contract. When this gets over, I'm going to be a hero with 40% of the country, and I'm going to walk into the Trump Hotel, and people are going to cheer for me. It's pathetic. It really is pathetic, and these are all the wrong reasons to take up public service, all the wrong reasons to go into the White House and to do this every day for 7 days, because it's a grueling job and it takes its toll. But to do it for your own personal advancement and to model your professional life on Donald Trump, you know, again, all these people will do fine. You look at, you know, Sarah Sanders, who's got a book coming out. She gets paid $50,000 every time she goes to give a speech. And she may be the next governor of Arkansas, you know, and, you know, maybe this works. But, you know, I think these people are going to have a tough time explaining to their grandkids how it all went down.
At a certain point, you have to wonder, what are you doing it all for? In other words, I have a lot of friends who are, you know, very successful lawyers who are very afraid to say anything about anything political, but certainly to criticize President Trump because he's making all sorts of appointments and, you know, it may impact their ability to get one of those or potentially to impact their ability to get clients or whatever. And I, at the end of the day, I mean, what is the point of all this if you're not doing things that you can feel good about at the end of the day or feel, you know, satisfied with what you've done?
Yeah, and that's why I think the most powerful part of the 21 hours of the House managers was late Thursday night when Adam Schiff was finishing his wrap-up. And he talked about the idea that you can't trust President Trump. You can't trust him to not put himself before the country. And I kept thinking about that, you know, for like, you know, I was up for a couple hours after it, and it kept, and I realized he wasn't talking just about Trump. He was talking to the senators in the room, and he was talking to the American public, which is, if you want this kind of leadership, the people who, you know, someone like Trump who calls everybody names and lashes out and lies and, you know, makes about himself, you know, this is what you get. But he was also saying to the senators, you have a choice here to put your country first or put yourself first. And then to the American people of, if you want to keep voting for Donald Trump, this is going to keep happening because, you know, the best leaders are the ones who do what President Clinton did, even with the, you know, the terrible mistake he made, which was to just say, I'm going to go do my job. I mean, if there's any, you know, self-indulgence or self-pitying happening, it's going to happen in private. I am not going to put this on you. What Trump has done is put it on the American people. What Republican senators appear to be likely to do is put it on the American people, say, not my problem. And, you know, the American people have a job. You know, I think Schiff implicitly challenged America to be better, to be about something bigger than themselves. You know, that's a pretty powerful argument if people get it. And if one of the Democratic candidates can find a way to articulate and bring that to life, because that's what beats Donald Trump, not, you know, going after him for this lie or that lie.
I think that's exactly right. It's very profound. And, you know, I think is a good way of summing this up. I appreciate you joining us, Joe. I've learned a lot from the discussion. You bring a perspective I don't think a lot of other people do to this. So thank you so much.
I appreciate it. It was good talking to you.
So now let's bring in our next guest, Elliot Williams. You know, Elliot's currently a principal at the Rabin Group's Government Affairs Practice Group, and you probably know him best as a CNN legal analyst, or maybe, during his roles in the Obama administration, because he was the Deputy Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs at the Justice Department. He was one of those people shepherding through Senate confirmations, for example, for Sally Yates and Loretta Lynch. But I think what's really relevant here and the experience he brings to the table is he actually used to work as Judiciary Counsel on the Senate Judiciary Committee for now Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. So he spent quite a bit of time. He's a practicing lawyer, but he spent, you know, quite a bit of time in the Senate. He understands how the Senate works. And as a lawyer, I think it brings a unique perspective as someone who can help us look at the legal side of this, but also understand how the Senate works and how senators may view this impeachment. So let's bring in Elliot Williams. Welcome to the podcast, Elliot. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always. Well, I've never been, so I shouldn't say always a pleasure, but it's always a pleasure to be in your company, Renato.
Thank you very much. Well, it's great having you, and I will tell you, we picked quite a night to do this. We just had breaking news that John Bolton's book alleges that President Trump told him specifically that he wanted to hold up the aid to Ukraine until and unless Ukraine helped with investigations into Democrats, including the Bidens. And it also, you know, makes a number of other claims that Pompeo said that the allegations against the ambassador that they were trying to get fired were false. It talks about a conversation he had with Bill Barr, in which he said that Giuliani was sort of putting himself out there as the Attorney General and Secretary of State and raising concerns about Giuliani's role. And the interesting, I think one, to me, very interesting thing is apparently he sent the manuscript to the White House weeks ago. So they know what's in what John Bolton's going to say.
Good point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and so look, you know, one thing, of course, that'll be interesting is to see what they contradict, what in the book contradicts what Trump's lawyers have been saying. But I also think, you know, it makes it harder for them to argue that senators shouldn't know what Bolton's going to have to say, given that they already know themselves.
Yeah. So I think big picture, are you surprised or should any of us be surprised by anything we're finding out? And you know, and I feel like over time, this happened with Watergate. To some extent, it happened with the Clinton matter. But I think with every major political, if you want to call it scandal, more comes out over time when the biographies start getting and the memoirs start getting written and information leaks out. So years from now, I think this is the tip of the iceberg in terms of the behind the scenes information that will ultimately be disclosed about the president's intent in this matter. So if this were a trial, which, you know, you've done many, I've done many, we'd call this corroboration of what we already knew, which is that the president ordered, the withholding of funds from Ukraine. And it was part of a months-long scheme to fire an ambassador, whatever. We don't need to get into all the facts here. But all this is doing is supporting what we already knew. And so I would, you know, if perhaps I could come on and show the outrage that we all feel about this conduct, but really we all kind of knew this. Now, the question is, what do we and what does the public do about it? And frankly, what the president's greatest skill since being since taking office has been convincing the public that he is under siege, that the media and Democrats in Congress and his deep state Republican opponents are out to get him. And people are just going to believe that this is just more fodder for his folks are going to believe this is just more fodder for that, that really all this is doing is compounding the baseless attacks against the president of the United States. And so it's heartbreaking that we've become so numb to the behavior and the misconduct from the president. But I don't think this changes anything in the end. But again, I think it just confirms what you knew, what I knew, what certainly more than a majority of the public knows. And frankly, the president's attorneys know. They have to know that the president's behavior was improper, but they're just casting it as completely proper as their defense.
Yeah, I have to say, I agree with what you said. You know, from my perspective, it's been clear for quite some time that what Trump did, there's no real question about it. I wrote a column in Politico, I don't know, two, three months ago now, saying the president has no defense. I mean, I didn't really see a defense on the merits here. I haven't seen much of one during the impeachment trial from his team. And yet, you know, what I think makes this an interesting development is that right now the debate is being centered on, should we call witnesses or not? And, you know, there's this old adage, you were a clerk just as I was for a federal judge. There's this old, you know, saying that I used to hear from judges and clerks, which is, does it right? In other words, come up with some justification that you put in writing that is sufficiently plausible that gets you from point A to point B that meets where you're trying to go? And we're getting to the point where I'm not sure it's possible for them to come up with an excuse that sounds reasonable or good as to why they're voting that way. But maybe it doesn't matter.
Well, you're thinking of this like a lawyer. You're thinking of this like a prosecutor. You're thinking of this like there is a substantive case to be made here that can't be superseded by a political one. And this process is, I hate to say it, being someone who lives in a world of facts and law, fancy that, like you do. But the political process is probably going to win out here. And I think in a political process, you can just convince the audience, convince the public that the underlying thing, the whole enterprise coming after you is flawed and tainted. And that's what the president has done and is doing. And so, yes, there is, let's say, the president's base is about 28% of the voting public, right? The people who, the unshakable base the president will never lose, right? Those folks necessarily believe that we're all out to get the president. The world is out to get the president, right? There's maybe persuadable people, a few more percentage points above that. But I just, maybe you're just catching me on a really cynical day. But no, I just don't see how. Again, this is supporting the legal case, but I don't think that matters anymore. Look, think of all of the acts of misconduct that we've seen by the president that, you know, did you sign the former federal prosecutor's letter in the Mueller? I just couldn't remember. The president could have been charged with at least four, perhaps five federal offenses, five different acts of misconduct. But the public just, you know, lots of people didn't care. And just think of all of the acts over time that we've just become desensitized to. If we lived in I wrote a piece for CNN.com that the only question that matters in the 2020 election is, does the law matter? Does it matter when someone breaks the law? Because of the fact that now we are now becoming dead, not we, but the public is just becoming dead to the fact that you can break the law or violate the Constitution or engage in acts of misconduct and still get away with it. And the question is, will someone who has engaged in misconduct be held accountable? And the cynical answer is that seems like the answer is no. It seems that you can just get away with it now. And I think the bar is now set incredibly low for presidential misconduct from here on out. And, you know, look, you're a student of history too. governments evolve, positions of the presidency has evolved over time, and maybe this is just where we're going, and maybe we'll eventually become Italy or something where the president is just constantly engaging in misconduct and changing every 2 years. I don't know, but again, the question is, does law matter? And I'm not convinced that it does anymore.
That is a subject I have a lot of.
That's dark.
I will tell you, that's a subject I have a lot of thoughts on, and sort of this whole subject of whether the law matters, and you know how what it means to you know what are people getting away with it in the age of Trump in a way that they haven't before. But I'm going to steer us to this impeachment for today, because I'll have to have you on again to discuss that, because I think that's huge. We could spend two hours or 10 hours discussing that.
And it's funny, that was just a digression. I forgot that I'd written that piece.
Yeah.
But literally that's – and CNN, you can look it up. Folks can look it up. It, basically, if you just Google what's the one question – Elliot Williams, what's the one question that matters in 2020? And I said, really, it does law matter? Do the rules matter? And do holding people – but whatever. We'll talk about that another day. It's a fun question.
It is. Well, I will tell you, I mean, I've managed to find one person who's perhaps more cynical than I am about this process. My listeners will know I'm a realist. I prefer calling it that. In general about this. But I will say that what I have seen when I looked at the trial is Republicans trying to come up with some sort of, what's the line that we're going to use to vote to acquit him? What's the line we're going to use to vote down witnesses? I just feel like this is making it harder from a political perspective to come up with something that when they go on the morning shows, they can move their lips and they won't get, you know, derided by journalists or by a certain amount of persuadable moderates. But maybe that doesn't matter anymore. I will say that one thing that I feel very strongly about, Elliot, and I think you're right, is that we shouldn't be thinking of this. And this is an issue that I think, you know, is the case with a lot of our listeners, because we got a lot of questions from all of you about this, you know, and you and I, Elliot, went through these, and a lot of people are focusing on legalisms and legal issues. Mm-hmm. And the reality of the fact is this isn't a legal process. I mean, one thing that I saw from a lot of pundits, and I talked a little bit about this in our Patreon newsletter, is, you know, there's this discussion like, oh, Adam Schiff just gave the best legal performance or the best performance by a lawyer I've ever seen. You know, that to me was not a legal performance at all. It was a political theater, political speech. What it means to be a litigator in court, I try cases all the time, is very different. The strategy involved in doing that, it's just a different exercise than what this is.
Yeah. And, you know, and both sides have, I don't want to call it two sides, like it's A versus B, good versus evil, or whatever. But, you know, there's the president and there's the people trying the president
the
in the court of impeachment. Mm-hmm. Managers, right. Or, you know, or the public that is on that side have sort of fallen into a trap a little bit of, not the managers, but more the public, of talking about this process as if it were a legal process. It started from the beginning. During the whistleblower, during a lot of the hubbub of the whistleblower, where it was the president has a right to face his accuser, right? That is a right, as you know very well, that comes from the Sixth Amendment, that is extended to criminal defendants. The president has a right to a jury trial or whatever. A lot of these fundamental rights that you work to protect both as a prosecutor or defense attorney simply don't apply to an impeachment. Now, the Senate can choose to apply those rights. You know, if the Senate were to craft rules for the impeachment that says, you know, the accused or the president or the elected official, doesn't have to just be a president, the high government official, you know, will have the same rights extended by the Sixth Amendment of the United States Constitution, or, you know, is free from search and seizure under the, you know, Fourth Amendment or whatever, Fifth Amendment, Fourth, I'm mixing up my amendment, sorry. But none of those rights apply. Pretty much all that applies is what's laid out in the Constitution and sort of filled in by Hamilton in a few of the Federalist Papers, like 65 being the big one, but there's a few others that sort of talk about, well, what is impeachment? It's not a criminal trial. And so also when, you know, you even hear talk about jurors, you know, the jury is you know, the senators are jurors and they should act. Well, they're not jurors. The clearest case of that is the fact that by a majority vote of the Senate, they can overturn any ruling
by the judge
of the chief justice. Right. So that's literally as if you were in a criminal trial, right? The judge said, you know, I'm sorry, objection overruled. And the jurors said, hey man, sorry, bro. Seven of us agreed. seven of the 12 of us agreed you're just wrong. And that was the rule. And that's one of many rules that really they are the impeachment court. That's a good way to call them, or the triers of impeachment, but they're really not, it's not a criminal legal process in the sense that we think of it. And so pretty much every question, and again, yeah, a lot of folks on your Twitter asked this.
Jason Jaffe was asking about, the principles of double jeopardy prevented the Senate from retrying the impeachment. You know, there's no double jeopardy in this context. It's not a criminal case. So if the House wants to keep sending articles over, the Senate can have at it with those articles.
But it's a political process. Then, if the public could certainly get fatigued by constant articles of impeachment coming out of the House. But to be clear, the right to confront one, and I don't want to poo-poo these rights, the right to confront one's accuser or the right to a jury trial or double jeopardy, not being tried twice for the same offense. These are all wonderful, beautiful rights that we ought to cherish and enshrine in law and protect, and they've been since the founding of the country. They just don't apply to presidents or federal judges or high government officials who are being impeached. That's just a fact of law.
Well, and I will just jump in and say, Elliot, it may be that those rights animate senators when they're setting the rules. In other words, another difference between jurors and senators is that senators decide the rules. I mean, if jurors in my trials got to decide the rules of how the trial would go, the trials would last like 2 hours long and everyone would go home.
Right.
And so, they're setting the rules. Maybe these principles you're talking about and these rights that are enshrined in the Constitution in criminal cases might have influence their decision making, but that's really all that it does.
Yeah, and I guess it comes down to the question of what is more important: protecting the rights of a president, or let's not even call it president. Let's say an individual facing impeachment. Because remember, it's not just about the president. There, I think, a few dozen individuals, federal judges, have been impeached over. Yeah, federal judges have been impeached throughout history. Secretary of War was impeached at one point for all kinds of crazy stuff, too, like showing up to work drunk. It's not just these lofty high crimes of, treason and breaches of oaths and stuff like that. No, literally showing up to work drunk could get you impeached in the old days. So, but what's more important, or what is most important? And it may not be the right to confront accused and so on.
Well, look, you're somebody who spent some time working in the Senate, in the staff and the Judiciary Committee. One thing I find interesting is I had worked briefly as an intern for Paul Wellstone back in the day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was a great guy. But, back then there's a lot of collegiality between Republicans and Democrats and mutual admiration and discussions back and forth. And it seemed like each individual senator had a lot of authority and power back then. That's changed a lot. And it seems to me like there's very much a political divide here. And it really, Democrats don't really seem to have, when you hear them, when they're coming and talking, whether it's on television or elsewhere, they don't seem to be giving much hope to how Senate Democrats that they're going to be able to, get many votes, even to have witnesses at this trial. I'm curious what your take is on this sharp divide, and is that sort of coming from something broader than politics, or maybe a difference in how the Senate operates?
Oh, that's an interesting question. So, I think that's another topic for its own podcast, right? Which is, how did we get here politically? And I think the big point is that the Senate is increasingly becoming like the House of Representatives, which is a place where up or down the majority rules. And I think it's not productive to get into the game of, well, did McConnell start it with Garland, or did Harry Reid start it with the filibuster, or whatever? It predates any of that. But increasingly over time, the place is just getting more polarized. Now, I was there about a decade ago, and it was worse to some extent than it was in the 1990s or 1980s or 70s, or I mean, more diverse, obviously. But it certainly wasn't what it is now. And in fact, to be candid, the senator's office, so I work for Senator Schumer on the Judiciary Committee, the Senate office, I think definitely the Republican office we worked with the most or the best was Lindsey Graham's office a decade ago, because, at the time Schumer was, he wasn't majority leader or minority leader yet. He was working a lot on immigration and criminal justice issues and so on. And Graham's office was always an office. One, they were staffed well. He just had smart, good folks on his staff. And he was someone certainly on the 2007 immigration bill. We worked very closely with them every day. And it was just an office that was universally respected across both sides. I don't know what's going on. What happened to Mr. Graham in South Carolina? Now, obviously, he's facing a tough race. He's up now, but I don't know. And to some extent, it's Donald Trump having a greater grip on any political party on his political party than any president we've seen in our lifetimes. Like, certainly Obama didn't have this kind of hold on Democrats. Bush didn't have this kind of hold on Republicans, where there's just a lockstep refusal. But I don't know, but it is troubling. And in fact, when I worked there in the Senate, we almost kind of looked down on the House of Representatives as this place where, you know, it was this far more partisan and far crazier, and there were no rules and everything was crazy. But the Senate's sort of becoming that now. And, you know, there are, like I said, it's the subject of another podcast, because I don't know if it's just money right now is making everyone so crazy about. I'm just going to throw out a few theories. One, it's money, and they just have to raise far more money now than they did before, and they always have to be making donors happy in a way that they probably didn't 50 years ago. Trump, I don't know if it's that. It's also the reddening and bluening, for lack of a better term. Bluing? Blowing? I don't know. But of the various districts or places in the United States. And so, for instance, Connecticut. So let's analogize to the House of Representatives, right? Connecticut, or not even Connecticut, I don't think above Pennsylvania there is a single Republican member of the House of Representatives. There might be one, but it's not in the way that it was 50 years ago, where red and blue represented the northeastern United States. It's a similar effect in the Southeast. There's usually one African American district, like in Mississippi, or, you know, a few in Louisiana or whatever, and that's the Democratic district, but the rest of them are deep red. So what that's saying is that the states themselves are becoming more polarized and partisan, and by extension, the senators that represent them might be becoming more polarized and partisan. Or maybe, I mean, another thing is, we are talking on a podcast right now, which is something that people can subscribe to. The simple fact is there is a ton of media that people can just choose to listen to, right? And you can just choose to tune out anybody you disagree with at this point. And I think that's making for a more polarized electorate generally. But for instance, like, just a last point on this, even as late as 2000, when I was in journalism school, where I also went with law school, at 6:30 p.m. on any given night, some staggering, like 80% of the households in the country were watching the nightly news, one of the three networks. It's some staggering percentage. Maybe it's not 80, but it's overwhelming, where everybody was tuned into the same news sources, NBC, ABC, CBS. Now, literally, you can only get BuzzFeed or the Daily Caller or Facebook or Twitter, and that's where people are getting their news. And to some extent, that's whipping up the people they're voting for. And I think they're just wanting more red meat out of their elected officials. So I don't know what it is, but it's infected the Senate, and it's not good for the, because, and last one, I know I'm going on for a minute, but the whole point of the Senate, this goes back to Thomas Jefferson, was to be the place where cooler heads would prevail. I mentioned Federalist 65 a little bit earlier, but in Federalist Papers number 65, they talk about the fact that the Senate is the trier of removal because they're the most level-headed people in America. And that's just shifted. That model just doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I think that the effects of this diversification of news sources, and the fact that we now can sort into the types of news sources that we are places that we're getting our news from, I think is just profound. I think the impacts of that are profound. Yeah. In my view, if I was going to put my money on something that's had kind of a corrosive impact on our politics, that would be it. I guess let's just turn back to this, the question of, sort of the political versus legal here. You know, it's been interesting to see the role of Chief Justice Roberts. Of course, one of the things that he did that actually, you know, made some impact was him chiding both sides to have some decorum. And we learned later that was because Susan Collins passed a note up to him complaining about, I think, Jerry Nadler, you know, making a statement about, you know, about hiding the truth or something like that. You know, it's interesting to me because, you know, of course, he also, I will say, he, you know, called the Senate the greatest deliberative body on earth. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem to be operating as it once did. But there's been a lot of discussion of Chief Justice Roberts, you know, having some big role here. You know, we had some listeners asking, you know, where would the Chief Justice stand on witness intimidation on Tweed, and, you know, why haven't the Democrats been slipping Roberts notes, you know, about, you know, lies from the defense lawyers and so on. What's your take on some of that?
Well, so here's the point, and this gets back to the very first topic we talked about here. What is an impeachment? Is it a trial? Is it something else? And the Chief Justice, this is another misconception about how impeachment ought to work or how it has worked in the past, which is that the Chief Justice isn't a judge in the sense that we think. He's not the trier here. The Senate is. He's not the finder of fact and law as a judge would be in different types of trials. And so, for instance, I think if you analogize or compare him to Chief Justice Rehnquist from some years ago, the goal of the Chief Justice, his one goal is to not become the story. His one goal is to not become the party at the center of a political maelstrom because he picked one side over another. And you know, the Susan Collins example is an excellent case of it, because you could make an argument that Jay Sekulow was just as problematic, at his behavior was just as problematic as Jerry Nadler's was, but a note had come from Susan Collins, the great moral voice in the Senate, and he sort of felt he had to do it. But you know, again, getting back to it, this is the point we made earlier. The senators can overrule anything the Chief Justice does, and I think that would be profoundly embarrassing for the Chief Justice to issue a ruling that would anger or inflame one of the political sides and have them vote to overturn him. Well, if only the Republicans could, but to overturn him. So the goal is just to stay out of it and keep his powder dry and really act as a ceremonial figure. Again, back to Rehnquist, you know, the most notable fact of William Rehnquist's time in the Clinton impeachment was that he adorned his robe to look like a character from a Gilbert and Sullivan musical that had stuck with him, Yolande. And it's like, and not even like Pirates of Penzance or HMS Pinafore, this random ass Gilbert and Sullivan musical that nobody's ever seen, but the judge there had four stripes on his robe. And so that's what you remember about William Rehnquist. No ruling, no fact, no whatever. He made one ruling on a motion, and it comes full circle because it's something we were talking about earlier. Was it Harkin?
Yeah, Tom Harkin asked the question.
Mm-hmm. Right. Are senators jurors? And he said, no, they're actually, I guess, what was it? Finders
court
of
or something, yeah.
Impeachment or some, yeah. You know, wishy-washy thing. So no, yeah, I mean, people want Chief Justice Roberts to be, both sides want him to be their ally in this. And he's really just, you know, a ceremonial figure keeping the trains running and trying to get back to his day job.
Yeah, I would say, I would put it differently. I think the Democrats want him to be their ally. Republicans are happy with where things are at. They want to get this over with. They're not looking for anything to get shaken up. That's the reason that they don't want witnesses is just not because that's going to really change votes either, but they just don't want anything that could potentially be a wild card that can move the needle. They got the votes. Let's get this thing over with. If you got the votes, call the votes, right?
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I think, you know, same thing with Bolton. You know, no one knows what his testimony will
be. The White House knows because they got the book.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Fair enough.
We don't know.
But I think, but everybody wants to graft their feelings onto John Bolton, like the cipher into which, you know, but yeah, but nobody knows. Except the White House, but they're not telling us.
Well, I'm curious. You've been watching all this coverage. Sometimes you've been on. I've seen you on CNN, Elliot. What do you think is the sort of big misconception or misunderstanding that's out there about impeachment thus far?
Well, the big. I hesitate to think there's one. I mean, again, it's number one that it ought to operate like a traditional court. that it ought to, that the rules apply in a court. You and I are here talking about legal issues that were this just and right would matter, but they just don't. And it's largely a political process. You know, the big thing, I think a big point that has troubled me a lot is this whole, and again, I think I touched on it a little bit earlier, is overturning the results of an election. You hear the president's supporters say what the House managers and Nancy Pelosi and everybody want to do is overturn the result of a duly elected president of the United States. Now, that is kind of the point of impeachment, right? It's the point that the framers laid out was that sometimes a duly elected or duly sworn or appointed official will behave in a manner that is inconsistent with his or her oath of office and must be removed, right? But saying that this is a political, that's just wrong as a matter of law. The problem is, you know, that doesn't matter. Again, I think that's the great tragedy in all this, that a lot of things that we associate with the rule of law, a lot of the rights that we associate or not even, you know, the rights extended to defendants, but also rules that ought to govern the process simply don't apply here. And it's just really a question of, can you convince the public that it's right or wrong? And so this whole overturn the results of an election point, I think is going to, it actually resonates with many people because people are saying, wait a second, they want to relitigate 2016 and 2020 is just, this is 10 months from now. So let's just forget impeachment. Let's just decide this at the ballot box with lightsabers. Like, you know, like Count Dooku would say, like, you know, with our, like, let's decide this like Jedi or whatever. That was a random, but whatever.
Hey, I'm a Star Wars fan. So I got the reference. I think maybe 5% of our listeners will.
Well, I love you 5%, but no, there's a point where Dooku says there's one way to solve this problem with lightsabers, right? Well, there's one way to solve this problem with the vote. And I think, you know, that's unfortunate because there is a system for holding someone accountable and it's just not going to hold that person accountable. It's clear he's not going to be removed from office. He's impeached. And in a little personal anecdote, like I remember when you were a nerd as a kid too. I know this. I had this book, like this encyclopedia of presidents when I was a kid. And I remember to this day, I remember the entry for Andrew Johnson. And it just says, you know, Andrew Johnson, 18, whatever, 65 to whatever year he came out. And it just said in italics under it, impeached. Right. And that was the one fact I knew about Andrew Johnson going through life until I got to high school or whatever. And it's on his record. He was impeached. But that's, I think, where it ends for Donald Trump. And to some extent, that's unfortunate because we've confused this political and constitutional matter. So I think that's the big problem in all this.
Yeah, well, it's unfortunately that has to be where it ends for us because my studio time is running out. But I will say, that you have given me topics and fodder for about 5 other podcasts with you and me. I think we're gonna have to have you on again. So I really appreciate that.
I appreciate it too. And one more sentence in this 30 seconds we have left: you don't need to have a crime for someone to be impeached. But whatever, we can talk about that another day. But I'm sure someone's talked about it on your impeachment. But whatever.
Thanks, Elliot. Real pleasure.
Thank you for having me. This is a beautiful thing.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.